Welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. This is your host, Andrew Vitelli, senior editor of Energy in the Americas for InfraLogic. Thank you for tuning in. Joining us today is Izette Bensouzen, founder and CEO of energy transition investment firm, Captona. Izette, thank you for joining the podcast.
Andrew, thank you for having me on your podcast. I've been following it for a while, and I'm really excited to be on this show. And thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Well, I'm certainly excited to have you on and glad to hear that you've been a longtime listener. So today, there's plenty to talk about in the energy transition space, in particular, the ways that investors are responding to policy changes like the One Big Beautiful Bill, which I understand people are calling OB3 now, some new lingo there. And where it might be creating opportunities even in the space. And we're going to get to all that. But first, Izette, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background and what brought you into the energy transition sector?
Thank you for that question. I am the CEO and founder of Captona, which is now identified as an energy transition investment firm. However, I would say that we have been doing this for more than a decade, meaning under our umbrella, we have assets that we built, we own, and operate. And interestingly enough, it meets the definition of energy transition investment, meaning we have solar farms, fuel cells, renewable natural gas plants, large batteries and storage, microgrids. And our investment mandate covers pretty much anything and everything that generates electricity as well as fuels. Beyond that, actually, I have been in this space for about 17 years. I'm also the founder of another firm called Carbone, which has been in the business since 2008. Now, today, trading several billion dollars worth of power, capacity, fuels, commodities like RINs, LCFS, D3, RECs, SRECs, and the likes across the United States for a very long time. And we also do have an AI-enabled energy transition commodity market data platform that the usual investors and traders that you know also use the data to try to predict the future price of all the commodities we're covering today. Now, you did ask the question how I got into this. Prior actually to this business, I have been in the business of information security and had built a large company with a few partners of mine, which had about 1,000 people that we sold in about 2007. And back then in 2008, some listeners may or may not remember, carbon credits was the biggest market forming around the world, and it was coming and making its way into the United States, along with the burgeoning and the growth of solar and wind. And back then, I wanted to enter a new space. IT has always been an exciting space. So is now what we define energy transition back then, carbon and the likes. So I decided to, after looking at several options, and I always joke with my business partner, the option I wanted to do was an online version of Zagat, since it covers food. I got into energy transition and 17 years later, here we are, almost to the date.
Well, when I launch a food podcast, I'll have to have you on that one too to discuss it. But that's very interesting. And when you talk about the energy transition from your perspective, what does that cover? What investment classes would you look at?
So the way we look at energy investing is looking at the new generation coming online is the way we look at it. And the premise of our firm has always been buying up long-dated assets, these assets being 30 years long, having long-term contracts, again, selling power, capacity, fuels. That's kind of the mindset behind it. So everything we bought, we always bought not with the idea that we are going to own a solar farm or a wind farm or whatever else it may be. We looked at the idea, how do we build a portfolio that generates cash flows every year, but also becomes a source of energy, especially in the world of electricity. And when you start thinking that way and you kind of look at it, a real energy portfolio, then you start thinking, what is my role? Obviously, until 15 years ago, conventional energy dominated every aspect of it that we define as coal, gas, nuclear, hydro types of sources, which started to be replaced or not really replaced, but added on by the new sources of energy. We used to call that new energy rather than energy transition assets. And it became quite clear that the components you look at, like solar, wind, fuel cells, RNG, batteries, microgrids, run-of-the-river hydro. All these other sources became our focal point, and we started to build our portfolio now, coming closer of an enterprise value close to $3 billion. And we do have all the different components that we like. And at the end of the day, we think of ourselves as a generation investment firm.
Well, very interesting, and thank you for that explanation. As we discussed a little bit in the intro, this is a time of transition in the energy transition space, particularly driven by policy changes, and the biggest one being, you told me that people are calling it OB3. I really like that name. It's quicker than saying one big beautiful bill every time, so I'm going to use that from now on, particularly by OB3, but also by tariffs and some other executive actions. What's it like being in the energy transition space right now, and how are you approaching some of these changes?
That's a very good question. I know there is a lot of sometimes negative sentiment in this industry sometimes. However, let's think of history, and then I will conclude by telling you that I have never been more excited about the business of energy transition, investing, and growth than in my 17 years. Now, I did tell you, we have close to 60 people that focus on energy transition between our investment firm, the traders, and the market data side. So every day we live and breathe across the platform this very topic. There has been a lot of points in time, like 2009 was Waxman-Markey, I think that was the bill around carbon credits that failed. Then you had the cash grant from the government and the financial debacle. Then you had the big SREC program in New Jersey, which then was the big SREC program in Massachusetts. Then you had something along the lines of like a feed-in tariff in California. And the history goes on. Then you had the sunset of PTC, sunset of ITC. Then they came back. They got voted in by one government and another. But back then, we were on the fringe as far as investing in this space and operating and having a job in this space. Today is completely different. Today, actually, I think a lot of people in this last version of Congress debating and coming up new laws, just remember they have done this more than 8 times, not only on the federal, but many, many more times at state level. We are looking at a future where there has been areas that are not favored by some, but areas that have been favored by a lot. When you look at OB3, you say, well, if it were about, quote unquote, as some call it, killing an industry, you wouldn't see batteries. You wouldn't see ITC for a run-of-the-river hydro or hydro in general. You wouldn't see all the push for nuclear and the very many likes. And you wouldn't even have this latest version, 5%, which we can discuss later, construction, safe harboring, all of those. So in my opinion, today there is much more options to invest in than there were before, being just call it solar. And I know under the IRA, there were other options too. Something happened in the last 3 years. One, the cost of generation from, let's call it energy transition assets, have come down significant amount. Two, with the demand that has never been seen as an unseen in the longest time for power, you have $3 to $4 trillion investment requirement to build up new generation. So that is a very big deal. And with that, I think that the thought line that we look at our energy transition portfolio, and I say, well, not only I can do all of them, but I can add on new ones. So to me, there is very, very many good things that's going to come out of this OB3. I can further giving some facts. Obviously, when you have solar ITC going away, which by the way, I think it's very important people realize that that's a 3 to 4 year process, not today to tomorrow. Then you could say, well, what does that really mean? Most people don't ask that very key question. The cost of solar today, the power generated that can be generated at the plant level, is somewhere around $50 per megawatt. If you lost your 30% ITC permanently, and I'm going to put a comma there, I say if, because if I have learned anything, every 2 years in our world, is a new legislation, the pendulum goes left or right, and you never know what's going to happen. Now, back on the track, I would say the increase of cost at 30%, all else being equal, would still translate into a 15% to 20% increase at the actual delivered power. It's not a linear equation. It's not a one-to-one. Now, then I got very curious myself, and I said, well, Why is it that, for instance, solar is $1.12 to $1.25 in the US when in Spain is 64 cents? And, you know, I did that for Europe because I wanted to compare the same labor laws, the same cost of building, etc. In the US, we still have enough profit margins that can be squeezed a little bit down. And listen, all we're talking about is reducing by 20 cents. We'll still hold the most expensive flag. But my point is, this may be the energy transition transitioning to be independent. So you have to see the positive in it. And there is room. Now, if we were Spain at 64 cents, I would say there's no room. But when we're the US, there is room. And then the second thing is, it's going to put a lot more pressure because people are demanding the power and they're going to read their bill and it's going to say, well, 50% to 60% of your cost is the grid. And somebody's going to say, well, we need to focus our effort in modernizing, capitalizing, and focusing our reduction efforts there at some point. So I see a lot of opportunity. So to me, OB3 introduces a lot of opportunities. I think it's a very good time. I can tell you our firm, which again is an energy transition investment firm where we buy, build, and operate assets, is going to look to triple its capacity in investing in these assets.
And when you say these assets, are you talking about solar specifically or across the spectrum?
I mean solar, fuel cells, RNG, batteries, microgrids. I'm big on run-of-the-river hydro as well. And in addition, we have been looking at different sources of nuclear, seeing what and what wouldn't work since it's split into conventional nuclear as well as SMRs. But that's a five-year plan. We need to see what's going to go fast and behind the meter. But I just think across the board, you have lots of opportunity. Nothing is dead, by the way.
Well, Lisette, you mentioned the growth in power demand that's been spurred by AI, onshoring manufacturing, etc. And obviously, that's been a major theme for us this year. And that's kind of tied into the question of what impact this bill is going to have. The question is, well, we need all energy sources because we need to grow the power supply. And because other sources are not ready, and we get a little bit more into nuclear later, but nuclear, natural gas aren't ready, these solar projects are going to have to get built. And if some of those costs get passed on to the consumers or to the off-takers, that's what's going to have to happen. The counterargument to that has been, listen, when you have PPAs that have been in place, when you have prices, price expectations that have been set, that's not going to be so easy to flip a switch and have higher prices, et cetera, without these incentives. And just through that process, a lot of projects are going to die along the way, and we might not be able to meet the power demand. It sounds like you think that greater efficiency, maybe a little bit tighter profit margins are going to be part of that story?
Yes, I do. I think people, when they talk about prices, need to look at what it means in the overall. Let me give you an example. Your bill, your power bill, is generally, the consumer's power bill is generally a combination of electric generation, the actual source, plus distribution and all the other charges that, you know, you never a mathematician or a PhD cannot figure out. But generally speaking, on average, 40% is the cost. Now, we talk about cost and we say, let's just say it goes up by 20 or 30%. That's 30% of the 40. So that would add 12 cents, right? So in the overall, you're adding only 10 to 12% at the most intense case. And price elasticity for power still has room to grow, where especially big users are really not going to budge down on a 10% increase. Now, I think it's worth also looking to note that price of source of power was lower only 3 years ago, and it's been going up post IRA. It hasn't been coming down. And that's a function of many different things. Who knows what? I could just explain it by saying inflation. I could explain it by saying different things like interest rate, cost of capital, cost of goods, whatever it may be. But the bottom line is that 10% is going to be invisible. I mean, if you look at the power output, it's not just coming from one source. Overall, if you really bundled everything together, you will not see such a big increase. And I do really think that the price pressure is going to put pressure on areas where you can be more efficient. So I do think that price pressure is not going to make people not build plants. They will build plants. And the buyers of these sources of power, call it AI, call it manufacturing, their cost of power is definitely not 90% of their whole operation, meaning they're spending marginally on power and many, many other things, but it won't affect them to the point they will say, I will not build. The biggest cost in AI, and we see it, is individuals, it's componentry, it's so much more, and it's in the billions and trillions. Who knows? I stopped counting, but I think the power is not it. So I do think that having now certainty, like people don't pay attention. This was done fairly quickly. A lot of things have been explained. And now we're only 6 months, or actually we are somewhat 6 months into this administration, and they delivered their final bill. They gave us the guidance. Now it's up to us, to the entrepreneurs, to just make it work around it. And we know that we have all of this demand. I'm telling you this because over 17 years, I've seen so many different programs giving so many wishy-washy answers for so long. But even in those markets, we grew because we are transitioning, not away, but with conventional power to new generation sources. So I don't think the cost increases of at the bottom line of 10% is a big deal, which may not even happen.
And you mentioned, obviously, Captona is an investor in solar as well as other technologies. Post OB3, are you shifting your attention towards any of those other technologies? And are there instances where you think that the bill or some of the other policy changes have made other investment classes or investment types more attractive? I shouldn't say asset classes. I mean, let's say RNG or another fuel cell, something along those lines.
We do own and operate and invest in fuel cells. We have one of the largest fuel cell portfolios. We are building the world's largest RNG plant from organic food waste. We did invest in over 2 gigawatts of batteries, including also microgrids as well. And we have solar. We don't shift away. I mean, we look at every option out there. Now, this question might be more along, let's fold all under energy transition. If the question were along the lines of, would we do natural gas power plants? The answer to that question is not even my choice. There just aren't any turbines to buy for delivery before 5 years, 3 years, depending who you ask. That's a lesser problem, believe it or not. The bigger problem is it costs, according to some, up to 1.5, 2 times more than what it did in the past to build a nat gas-fired power plant. Now, you have that first problem, and then you have the massive interconnection problem. So you can't just keep building very massive baseload without access to the interconnection. Even if you said, I will do it behind the line, you also need to get gas line. It's a very complicated equation. Are there one-off opportunities here and there? Certainly. However, I think for what we look at, and our aim is to put a certain amount of dollars to invest in projects, and I think we have so much to choose from. Like I said, I mean, we may expand our fuel cell portfolio. We may expand our RNG portfolio, batteries, microgrids, and look at new solutions like repowering run-of-the-river hydro, which I think is very exciting. I don't know why people forgot. By just doing that, you can have a benefit to those plants that are not functioning well anymore, but they can be baseload. But also you fix up the environments they're in. And the list goes on. So the quick answer is we don't have an opposition to it, but I don't think there's even an opportunity to invest in a conventional plant because your choice is not gas plants. And good luck finding a newly built, because we only invest in newly built coal-fired power plant, which is not going to happen, as you can imagine. But we like our space energy transition.
And you mentioned earlier nuclear power. That's obviously something that a lot of people are looking at. When they look 10 years, 15 years down the line, that's something we've been writing about recently. Where do you see opportunities there? I mean, is that something that you think can be investable for a company like yours, or is it going to take a long time to get there?
We possibly can do an investment. The problem with nuclear power plants is the duration in which a power plant can come to life. However, I have seen a lot of, how do you say, hype in different kinds of technologies. What we didn't cover is that back in the day, we did close, almost closed, on 2 green hydrogen plants, one in California, one in Canada. And if you recall, 3 years ago, if you said hydrogen, everybody wanted to talk about it. Now, nuclear is experiencing the same renaissance right now, making a comeback. And I certainly hope that it stays. That is my desire. And I say that because it is a very good technology. It's a very good solution. And now with the, you know, SMR, small modular reactors, you actually may have a solution to baseload in locations where you don't have to run, per se, a gas line or anything like that. Now, do I think that this is going to become business as usual, say, 7 years from now? It might, and people may look at it another source of power that's very manageable. But it all comes down to people's will, comfort with, and they're not in my backyard type of comfort. Hopefully it is. And a good education behind it. And plus the technology becoming cheaper. But hey, whenever we get behind the technology, you do have the necessary growth in it. But for now, it's going to take 5 to 7 years to decide whether this has become a commonplace investment.
And I think the consensus, this is something we've been asking folks about for the last few months, is that the first movers, the first few projects are probably not going to be infrastructure type investors. They're going to be people a little bit higher up on the risk spectrum, but that there could be more appetite once a few of these projects are done, in particular when it comes to the SMRs. Now, you mentioned that Captona is the owner of the largest RNG plant. That's an asset class that we don't talk about as much, obviously, as wind and solar. So I'm curious, how is the RNG sector impacted by some of the policy changes that are going on?
RNG is positively impacted because it does have all the support and it does have all the backing it needs to continue growing. Let's take a second defining what renewable natural gas means. And for some listeners, I find it helpful to say renewable natural gas product is natural gas at the end of the day. It's the same molecule after all said and done. But the benefit of it is a real way to eliminate waste going and being released as a heavier gas, as in methane, and being converted to be used and not being released to the air. So that, from my carbon days, I can tell you, reduces by 20 times what would be otherwise emitted to the atmosphere. That's a good thing. But the really great thing is this plant that we're partners of, its business is to collect food waste that otherwise goes to a landfill and sits there for hundreds of years and becomes an eyesore and a source of God knows what goes into the ground. Instead, before it even makes it anywhere, in 30 days, the food wasted or organic waste converts into gas, and that gas replaces what otherwise would have been taken out of the ground and gets used for different kinds of purposes. So I do think that is a great technology and a great solution, especially for big cities or food waste and clearing up land too, because you're not building landfills. So there are other sources of renewable natural gas, which comes from dairy farms, comes from other livestock. And of course, there's landfill gas too. But at the end of the day, this gas is being generated and RNG is the solution to actually eliminate the problems it causes. And it's a win-win-win-win everywhere. There is no one losing. So I think it has gotten its support and it will take, with this technology, diverted food waste laws and all of the likes, with a solution out there to promote this fuel.
Well, it's interesting, and that's something maybe we'll see more of in the future if the OB3 is positive on that. Maybe we'll see more firms shift to investment opportunities there. Final question. You mentioned AI earlier in our conversation. And when we talk about AI and energy, it's usually about energy demand and the amount of energy that will be demanded because of the growth in AI. But I'm curious, do you think that AI itself has the capability to kind of transform the energy sector, make it more efficient, change the way that energy is produced?
I have a smile as well. That's a great question because there's all this talk about the fact that AI linearly grows and linearly consumes energy. And then I say, well, IBM or someone built the first, I even forgot the word, computer that was the size of a room or bigger even. And now we carry smartphones that does God knows how many more, 100 more times the same work with just using much, much less energy. So my opinion is also the fact that in the next 5 years, if the promised land is reached with this AI, then you would think the AI would also be the solution to actually come up with ways to reduce processing power, to have better chips, and who knows what. But at the same token, I say to myself, I think we put a lot of expectations to AI, like it's the next profit coming and solving everything, literally everything. And I do think that there's going to be a rebalancing in the next 3 years of understanding what is the real long-term power demand, which by then might also be transportation with electric cars, with better technology and electric planes. Like there is all that. Electrification is happening. So the demand may grow, maybe not at the same speed, and maybe AI will be the solution provider for a lot of the things, which looks like it's going to cause more demand than we can meet. That gets me to the point is we should not worry about 10 years. We should worry about the next 3 years on how to bring power to meet the current demand, because that doesn't look like anything's going to change in the growth of demand, at least even demand defined as in contracted demand. Because if I'm building a hyperscale AI center, I need to sign my contract today and next year. So that's when you start building it. Whether that energy will be used or not is to be seen, because no one can guesstimate how much is being built. And therefore, the fastest projects that can come online, which ends up being a very small set of energy transition that can meet the large demand, that's where you have the best 3 years ahead of us. And I would think that AI would solve that problem after 3-4 years. But we just have this like mental look at it saying like, well, if we feed all the information to a computer, it should spit out the solution. I've yet to see an Excel sheet actually run its own financial model and then tell me this is the IRR without me just doing anything. And it's been years they had that. So maybe there's still some wiggle room to say, let's see what happens.
Well, Izzet, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been a really interesting discussion.
Andrew, thank you for having me. And famous last words would be, people overestimate what they do in 1 year and very much underestimate what they can do in 10 years. And even we both look at our lives and look back, we say, I can't believe all of that happened. And same goes for the energy world. If it were 2015 right now, and you look forward to 2025, you would say, no way this will have ever happened. And look where we are. We are much more ahead and a lot more to do. I'm excited for the growth of our firm and the industry.
Well, I'm going to, after we get off the line, schedule you on for August 19th, 2035, so we could revisit all these predictions. So I hope you'll come back then. But thank you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into Crossroads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player, and please give us a 5-star rating so others can find our podcast. Until next time, this has been Crossroads.